Ross Owen Show is sponsored by DDayHistorian.com.
Bob Dylan and Union Sundown. Good afternoon, good evening, and good morning.
Black Sky Radio.
My special guest today is not only a star of the Outlander TV series, he's also been in Band of Brothers, which is one of our favourites here on the show. So we're going to be talking to Stephen Walters, who played Angus in Outlander. And the studio is actually just 10 minutes from my house. And in fact, I do lots of little bits of background extra work on it as well, every now and again. And I'm in it tomorrow. If you watch it, you might see me. In the meantime, we're going to play your requests, as always. Let me know where you are, where you're listening from. Send us a tweet at The Ross Owen Show, or you can contact us on Facebook. Just look for The Ross Owen Show and leave a comment on the page.
Y-V-O-N-N-E-E-V-A.
The Ross Owen Show is sponsored by DDayHistorian.com.
It's probably one of your all-time favorite television series. And this December, it's your chance to meet the actors who portrayed some of World War II's most well-known paratroopers. Join the actors from television's Band of Brothers series this December in Bastogne, Belgium, as they gather to honor the veterans of the Battle of the Bulge and in support of the nonprofit World War II Foundation. For the past 2 years, the actors have reunited in Normandy, France, and thousands of people have had the opportunity to meet them. Now, for the first time, the actors are visiting another of the most historic locations of World War II, where the 101st Airborne Division held off German counterattack after counterattack during some of the most extreme weather conditions witnessed in the entire war. We hope you join us in Bastogne for 3 days of amazing events with the Band of Brothers actors and veterans. Please visit www.wwiifoundation.org and click on our events link to order your tickets. The actors will see you in Bastogne, Belgium, December 9th through the 11th.
Hi. I'm Paul Woodedge, D-Day historian, a battlefield tour guide in Normandy, France. I offer tours of the D-Day landing beaches of 1944, along with my partner Magali. If you would like to find out more, see my website at www.ddayhistorian.com and my partner Magali's at www.ddayforyou.com. I am proud to be supporting the Ross Owen Show.
Black Sky Radio.
You're listening to the Ross Owen Show on Black Sky Radio, if you've just tuned in. My special guest today, coming up very shortly, Stephen Walters, who plays Angus in Outlander. Stephen joining us on the show in just a few minutes. Some of you may not know this, but Stephen is actually, he's also a musician. And before he played the part of Angus, he recorded these two songs, which I'm going to play for you right now. And after these songs, we're going to get Stephen on the show to talk about his role as Angus in Outlander and also to talk about his role as John McGrath in Band of Brothers.
Stuck in a 5-star hotel, I got concierge on tap. I see 16th century buildings from my window. Won't you please pick up the phone? I'm missing home. I'm missing home. Home, sweet home. Missing walks on Blundell Sand. I'm missing Bow Street on a Sunday. I'm missing grey skies on a Wednesday. I'm missing places that we go. I'm missing home. I'm missing home. Home. You are more colorful than rainbows. I'm missing home, home, sweet home.
I'm
The Ross Owen Show is sponsored by DDayHistorian.com.
Sing me a song of a lass that is gone. Say, could that lass be I? Mary of soul, she sailed on a day over the sea to sky. Mole was a stem, rum on the port, ecky on the starboard bow. Glory of youth glowed in his soul. Where is that glory now? Sing me a song of a lass that is gone. Say, could that lass be I? Mary of soul, she sailed on a day over the sea to sky. Give me again all that was there. Give me the sun that shone. Give me the eyes. Give me the soul. Give me the lad that's gone. Song of a lass that is gone. Say, could that lass be I? Mary of soul, she sailed on a day over the sea to sky.
My guest this week has appeared in Mean Machine, Band of Brothers and Hannibal Rising, but he's been making waves recently as Angus in the Outlander series, and I'm delighted to welcome Stephen Walters to the show. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ross, and it's nice to speak to you, man.
First of all, congratulations on the success of your character in Outlander. You really brought that guy to life, and as a fan of the show, I was absolutely gutted when he died.
Ah, thanks, man. We won't tell your audience how much you've paid you for saying that. you know what? No, that's cheers, man. I mean, yeah, it's kind of the sort of the audience reaction from it surprised me. I mean, I don't know what I expected, to be honest. But it seems like it struck a chord with the fan, and the reaction was kind of, well, when the app went out, was pretty phenomenal, actually. It was quite sort of, without sounding corny, it was quite touching that people feel connected to such a character that they expressed it in their own way, you know?
Did you know going into it, when you first landed the role, did you know this series was going to be so popular?
No. Do you know what? No. I mean, I remember the casting director at the time, Suzanne Smith, saying that it was really popular, the books and things.
Mm-hmm.
But I, to be honest with you, I went into it quite ignorant, like another gig. I didn't know anything about the books. I didn't know anything about the story. To me, it was just an audition and another part. And then it's only, obviously, when I sort of were further down the line and got involved in the actual filming up in Scotland, and I realized what a big deal it was sort of up there, and then what a big deal it was to sort of Diana's sort of book readers all over the world. Like, oh, bloody hell, it's a different kind of animal than what I thought. So in a way, that the naivety before was kind of good, because I like to stay green and quite sort of naive about things. And then obviously the more I got into it, I realized the repercussions of how big the actual show was, you know?
Sure. I remember when I first started watching it, and I started to think, oh, this isn't for me. This is a romantic thing, and I'm not really into romantic things, you know. I thought, no, just a...
Yeah.
And then you guys came into it, and that kept me watching. And then the story just got so interesting, and now I'm hooked on the show. Not only am I hooked on the show, but I live in Cumbernauld, and I do occasional extra work on the show. So it's like, it's just bizarre walking into one of my favourite shows,
yeah.
You know, it's bizarre. But you mentioned your audition. Can you tell us how you first got the part and about the audition process?
Just like any other one, really. The casting director, I've got to give credit to Suzanne Smith, because I know Suzanne before. She kind of brought me in, and she was joking, because the character in the book is hardly mentioned, and when he is, I think he's about 6'8" or something. And I was like, well, I think I'm the wrong guy. And we were laughing about it. And she felt that I could bring something to it, or embody the spirit of it in some way, or bring, you know, a different character to it in my own way. And she sort of, you know, credit to her for bringing me in, actually.
Did you have to do the accent in your audition?
Yes. Yes. I was looking. I've got a good mate, actually, same name, Ewan Ross, who's a Scottish actor. He knew about it, actually. I didn't. He knew about it, and so he helped me with the accent and stuff, and sort of went over it sort of the way a dialect coach would, you know, which was handy. Actually, I'd done a Scottish accent for an Irvine Welsh thing that kind of went bankrupt, a thing called State of the Party, aka Bobby Preston, and it was a feature film.
Right.
So I had done a Scottish accent, and that felt, the only job I'd done that fell through because of money. And so I'd done it, but I needed to brush up on it, and Ewan was great. And also, actually, for that meeting, I took my teeth out when I read for it. I've never done that before, actually. I always wanted to for a role, you know, and I just sort of felt that Angus was a brawler. He was a drinker. He had, you know, I'd imagined he'd been in a few fights and, you know, probably would have lost his teeth or something.
Sure, sure.
And
sure.
It just seemed to fit, you know, just everything, all them elements seemed to fit. Did you enjoy your filming when you did it?
Do you know what? It's just surreal. I love it. I love doing it. It was a cold, cold day. I'm in this week's episode coming up, and it was really, really cold. But you know what? You get past all that, don't you? And you just think of the finished product. And you guys, I take my hat off to you guys. I seen Sam standing there in the cold, wet rain, having a sword fight. And so you guys obviously get through all that. It's for hours.
Listen, what people don't know is we've got bloody water bottles under our kilts, and we get given coffees and everything. So don't feel too sorry for us.
Now, we were talking about the accent. How did you deal with the speaking Gaelic?
The Gaelic, we had a guy called Adam O'Brien, or Brolin.
Oh, yes.
It was just the Gaelic name for his name. And he was just, It was a thing that was just in the scripts from the beginning, and I think it was a nice, it was like a little spice in a meal. It just gave it a little, I thought it was just something a bit different, especially because it didn't have the subtitles as well, so you had to kind of guess what was being said.
Yeah.
And it was just little phrases, and, you know, if we had a little moment in the script, we chucked them in every now and then. If we felt, we'd say, you know, what would you say if somebody, you know, kicked you in the nuts or something, whatever it was, and then you'd say it, and you'd go, okay, if I can, I'll throw it in, you know. And sometimes they let us do that, and we got away with quite a few Gaelic expressions that were not actually in the script.
Now, Angus and Rupert are often referred to as the Laurel and Hardy of Outlander, but I read somewhere you guys didn't play it with comedy in mind. Is that right?
No, I think that should be rephrased to the we were the crankies of the Outlander. Laurel and Hardy is a bit highbrow, but I mean, you know, I'll take it. I'll take whoever's being paid to say that. I'll take it.
Lots of people are saying it.
No, I know. You know what? I mean, obviously, it's nice when someone says something like that, but it's like writing a song and someone saying you sound like the Beatles. It's a ridiculous sort of comparison, really. I don't know what Grant says or feels, but I always felt, again, a little bit like reading the books in retrospect. Mm-hmm. You know, the chemistry or the humor that was there, you know, or whatever it was something for me anyway that came later. I never actually saw that in the scripts, believe it or not. And I think if it did develop or what developed, it kind of developed as the show went on. And I think it was a kind of bonus to the makers of it, and they saw that and kind of ran with it a little more. And what was nice was Diana Gabaldon, I think she's on record as saying it is the best addition to the show in terms of the adaptation from the books. It strays from the books somewhat, but it fitted the show, which was nice, you know.
And it also strayed from the book in the sense that in the book, Rupert dies before Angus, is that correct?
I know. Yeah,
and so a lot of people, to a lot of the fans, it was a big surprise, even to the fans who knew the book.
I don't know if you know the story; it's sort of out there now, so I'm not like speaking sort of out of terms. There was originally the actor that played Willie; they had written it so that he would die at Preston Pans, and what happened was, I don't know, because he wasn't contracted, or I think they assumed that he'd just come back and, you know, gratefully do it, and he'd said he couldn't do the job, so it was a toss-up between Grant and I, and they decided it was me. But, you know, it's funny, again, at the retrospect now, sitting here talking to you, Iris Stephen, that he wrote that episode, I think he wrote a lovely arc for Angus in that final episode, and it was nice. It was kind of like a seal. I kind of got my own death. It was a kind of finality to it. I didn't kind of genetically die in a war, and there was a nice pathos to it. There was a nice feeling to how it was written, and I think it, you know, like the great George Harrison says, all things must pass. So it was a nice bonus, that episode, in a way. I look at it now thinking it worked out well.
Well, like you said, you got a death scene. That's one of the things on an actor's bucket list for a star, isn't it? A death scene. What can you remember about filming that? Because it was pretty horrific.
Two things, really, I remember Kat's performance, because I kind of looking at it, and I actually remember after we'd finished it, I actually remember giving Kat a hug, because she was genuinely crying, which was, again, without sounding corny, was very moving, you know, and I was like, and I was kind of, you know, rubbing her back, saying, okay, you'll be all right, you know, it's only, you know, we're only, we'll make a drama kind of thing, but she really took it to heart, and that was beautiful, actually, without sounding, it was really moving. Mm-hmm. If you didn't nail it, because there was so much blood, and because of continuity, you know, it was on the floor, it was in my hair, it was in my beard, it was on other people, it was in costume, so there was a sort of nice pressure, I would say, to try and get it right first time, because there was only so many goes that we had at it.
Did they pour stuff into your mouth for you to keep in your mouth until it was time to see action, and then you started gargling on that? Is that what happened?
That's right. It just took a swig of this kind of, I think it's a little bit like that sauce they put on ice creams, you know, the ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was just kind of, because the way it was written as kind of a long sort of, you know, death. It was a slow death gargling. It was just a matter of, I don't know, it's like any, you know, they don't cover that at drama school, how to die on your own blood. It's just, you just use your instincts and and go for it, you know.
Yeah, I thought you played it very well. It was very realistic, and I think that noise really, that's what added to it, you know, the noise of the gargling and the sight of the blood. And and I can understand why Cat get upset, because it's an actor leaving the show. It's a member of the cast leaving as well. So there's that on top of it. There's that because there's such a bond on these shows, you know. And talking about bonds, you also appeared in Band of Brothers, which I was delighted about because we have interviewed the entire cast of Band of Brothers, just about every single member of the cast.
Wow.
And one of our listeners in New York, in fact, a guy called Philip Russo, sent me a very interesting email about the character you played in Band of Brothers. Let me quickly read it to you.
No way.
You played John McGrath. It says, "Hi, Stephen. I knew John McGrath, the Easy Company veteran you portrayed in Band of Brothers. He was a hugely humble man. He invited me to his home to learn more about Easy Company and the 506th. But to my knowledge, he was never interviewed by any other researcher or historian. He only found out about that Band of Brothers after his son saw his name in the book. When I met him, he could vividly recall firing at the German tank in Bloody Gulch with Welsh, and he described the scene in almost the same way as it was portrayed in the series. He passed away in 2012, and I was just wondering if Stephen ever got the chance to speak with McGrath or if he knew anything about the man."
Wow. No, that's quite moving, actually, hearing that, actually, because you kind of, when you don't meet, I've been fortunate enough to play people that actually, you know, exist and to meet them as well. And I didn't have any contact with John McGrath. I didn't know anything about his story, but hearing that is quite touching, actually, the fact that he didn't know about it.
No, he wasn't ever asked. He wasn't interviewed for the movie.
He was never asked about it.
No, he wasn't.
Wow.
He didn't even know about it until his son happened to read the book and saw his name in the book. And then, of course, you did the very scene that he mentioned with Harry Welsh when he shot the tank. And
wow.
Isn't that incredible?
It kind of fits in with that image of war vets being very private and not talking about the things that went on in war. It's kind of an ironic thing that he never gave an interview about it, in a way.
As Philip says, he was a hugely humble man, very private and quiet, and he was, you know, I think he kind of liked, he enjoyed the private life and the anonymity. He liked being anonymous.
Anonymity, easy for you to say.
Yes.
My memories of Band of Brothers really was that it was shot in Hatfield. We did some training. The sets were like Outlander. They were a world within its own world. It was just this big bloody hell. It was huge, you know.
Yeah.
And in my initial audition, I did a tape, and then I auditioned for Tom Hanks, which was mad, which was a surreal moment.
Did he have his big beard on? Did he have his big castaway beard?
He did. Yes. Yeah, he looked like someone out of Outlander. Yeah, he looked like one of the clan. And I think he'd lost a lot of weight as well. He did. He looked very, very skinny. He'd lost a lot of weight and stuff. But
sure.
It was for another part. I genuinely can't remember what it was. And then it went, and I just thought it had gone. And then my agent called, and they offered me John McGrath. So it was just the nice two episodes. It was just a bonus, really.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, you know, a bit, whether it's Band of Brothers or Outlander or anything else, in terms of if other people think it was great, which is brilliant, I've got to plead ignorance or naive in that. You know, most things that I've gone into or go into, I don't have that perception until much later. So it's only when other people tell me. To me, it's like the purity of it. It's just another acting gig that you do your best in. Whether it's a short film or some big massive film at some A-lister, you have the same mentality, or I try to anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nice to hear it, but it's not something I think at the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've heard so many different stories from the guys, and you know, that some people spent most of the time on set being the character the whole time, as you probably know, although that's the way Captain Dye wanted it, isn't it? He wanted everybody to remain in character.
Yeah. I mean, God, you'd never forget him.
Did you have any run-ins with Captain Dye?
You know what, I did, and I remember my story with him. He was a nice guy, though, you know. He was a nice guy, but I remember we were on this kind of kind of a, I don't know what you would call it in terms of a technical term, but we were all in a huge line spanning this field, and there must have been about, I don't know, at least 60 soldiers in a line, and I was right at the end, and he was saying, make sure all your guns have got the safety catch on, and like an idiot, I was talking to somebody, and I'd forgotten that mine was off, and all you heard in the silence of the field was,
oh, no.
And he just looked down the line and said, "Hell was that? Who is that?" And he comes right down the line. It's like being at school. You know, you're the guy, you're the kid at the end that's going to get it. And he roared at me, and he told me off. But I always remember that just that as he's walking away on this big field, and no one would have seen this. He just gave me a little wink.
Oh, did he?
He did. Oh. And I always remember him just being a really sort of, he had a great presence, had a great physical presence, and you know, he could sort of look at you, and he had that kind of thousand-yard stare, a kind of classic movie-type soldier vibe going on. But he was a nice guy, you know, and he was respected a lot, actually.
Well, I've heard so many different Captain Dye stories, and he's been on the show. I've spoken to him a few times, and he told me to get down and give him 20 when he was on the show. He said, "Get down and give me 20.
Get down and give me 20. Yeah. Again, I think those old timers that served in the war, and you know, it never, there must be a part of it that doesn't leave them, which is quite, again, it actually makes sense, but it's quite moving, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a big, you know, war aficionado and stuff like that, but I always, you know, it's a cliche, but they were sort of heroes, weren't they? You know, when wars were kind of won on the ground, in the mud, in the boots, in the trenches, and all them guys in those old wars kind of fought for our freedom, so it's something that we should never forget, really.
Well said. Now, I want to ask you, we played a couple of your songs earlier. Are you still making music?
I'm always making music. I mean, the role that I'm doing at the moment, I'm actually playing, I can't really talk about it because I'm bound and gagged by media through the production company, but what I can say is I'm playing a singer-songwriter, which is lovely, you know, because it gets to exercise that part here that you don't, that I haven't done as an actor, actually, so that's nice. But yeah, I mean, my guitar is the friend that doesn't let you down. You know, I take it with me all the time.
Now, you said you're playing, and you can't talk too much about it, but you're going to be playing a singer-songwriter. Can you tell us whether it's a real person you're playing? Is it a biography, like, or is,
no.
is it a fictional character?
No, it's a fictional.
Right, okay.
It's a fictional character set in a contemporary, in a depressed release that much. It's a contemporary Western. But it's not a Western, but it's got that vibe of a guy who's trying to escape his past and it comes back to haunt him.
Okay. Well, look out for that then. We'll watch out for that on in the future. And you've written a bit of a ditty about Outlander, haven't you?
Yes. I mean, it's something I just love to do. You know, if I get bored or something or I get an idea, I like to whip the guitar out and write it off. It's a blessing just to play an instrument. I always say to anybody, you can't learn an instrument because it stays with you all your life.
Yeah.
And if you can write, even if it's just for your own, you know, your own entertainment, then it's good. But yeah, I have written a few Outlander ditties, and I'll put them out at some point. You know, this technophobia will put them out. I've been on Twitter about 2 weeks, and I'm talking like I know what I'm on about.
Now, talking about Twitter, that's another thing. You've just joined Twitter. And you've been saying that since day one. I'm not quite ready yet. I don't know what I'm doing. But you've handled it pretty well, and you made your presence. You made a big impact on Twitter when you arrived. And I have to say, I was tweeting back and forth with William Shatner, and he says something like, "Tell him I was asking for him, or tell you know, it was a compliment, something nice anyway." And that was just a couple of days ago.
Blessing.
That was a couple of days ago.
It's my one little embarrassing blip on tweeting, because I literally went from one day saying to a friend of mine, like, I'm talking to you on the phone, so which button do I press, Scott? And he's gone, that button, and he's trying to guide me on it, and he went, look, just play with it and see how it goes. And literally the next night, I'm having a kind of heated debate with bloody William Shatner. I'm thinking, this is bizarre. You know,
welcome to Twitter.
I mean, I was having a banter with Kat, and he came in, and I thought it was somebody joking. And then I realized it was him. And then, because I didn't really know the protocol of Twitter, you know, I was a little over-enthusiastic, and I didn't know the rules. And again, in retrospect, William was, he was gracious enough to accept my apology and unblock me. I didn't know you could block anybody. Didn't know what that meant. I think he and I are all right now. But it was like, you know, it's not my intention with any in life, never mind the social media, to offend somebody. So
it's just banter, isn't it?
But it's fine. It's fine.
When Sean McGuire was on the show, he says, you know, that can happen. Sometimes just the difference in the translation, you know, it can be taken the wrong way. Yeah, the humour can be taken the wrong way. It's easily done, but I'm glad to hear it's sorted out. And he's still a fan of the show. And we got a question from Twitter from a fan of yours by the name of My ID Sucks. In fact, it's My ID Sucks Too. So I don't know whether she said two accounts or not.
Let's hope the question doesn't suck. Go on.
Well, the question is, who is your favourite Beatle and why?
Oh, God. Well, I was going to answer that like saying, who's your favourite child? And thankfully, I only have one, so I can answer that. do you know what? It has to be... I mean, it's so difficult because I think the four of them, I think it was Ronnie Wood described them as the four-headed monster. The four of them were so unique and so important to the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And if you understand music, you'll really know that. But if I had to pick one, it's got to be John, because I think Lennon had... I just think his songs have a more... There's more of an edge to them. They're lyrically sharper. They're a little bit more trippy. They're a little bit left of centre. And I think his solo career as well, what was interesting, you know, McCartney, there's no doubt about who, musically, Paul McCartney was streets ahead of them all in terms of playing instruments and even the range of his voice. But what Lennon did, Lennon always talked about his limited palate, whether it was his vocal or whether it was his guitar playing, but what he could do, he could always get a song out of something. And that was his gift. I think his songs came right from the gut every time, almost every time. And I think that's why his songs have more of a lasting impression on me than McCartney's. Although, I have to say that Paul McCartney is a living legend. There's no doubt about that.
Well, that's a great answer. That was for My ID Sucks Too. And she's in Las Vegas. So thanks for your question. I hope that answers it for you. Stephen, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Can I ask you just one question before you play out?
Absolutely.
What is your link and your fascination with Laurel Hardy? Why is that connection the way it is, and how does it sort of fold out in the future?
Right. I've been a lifelong Laurel and Hardy fan. I'm 47 years old, so I was kind of born into it. My mother liked them, and I just always remember watching my mum laugh at these guys on the telly, and that made watching her laugh made me laugh, and that's what got me into them as a 2 or 3 year old probably. And then of course growing up, they were on BBC Two, weren't they, when we were at school, and I watched those. I used to rush home at 5 and watched them at 5:40. They would come on for that seasonal run that they used to always do. That was in the '80s, and so I've always been a fan. And then when the internet came along, I was looking for Laurel and Hardy on the internet, and there wasn't much there. So I created the Laurel and Hardy forum, which has now become the world's biggest database of topics and conversations and information to do with Laurel and Hardy. So that opened a whole lot of doors. I started to meet and get chatting with all the top authors, and Stan's daughter, who's also a member of the forum. Celebrity fans started joining the forum. And then Twitter came along. And, of course, social media, you know, Facebook. So we more or less moved it to there.
Yeah.
And now you've not just got the Sons of the Desert, who are the Appreciation Society. You've now got all these new Laurel and Hardy fans and who are... how can I describe it? They're all screaming out for to get Laurel and Hardy back on the TV now. And so one of the things I said on Twitter, I said to everybody, go and see Laurel and Hardy in a cinema with an audience. That's the way they were made to be seen. And somebody got back to me and said, but there's no cinemas showing them. So last year for Stan's birthday, I hooked up with Showcase Cinemas and a few other cinemas, and we put them on across the whole country, across the UK and all the cinemas, and they all sold out. It was fantastic. We had two big celebrity screenings in London, and we're now doing it. Due to demand, we're now taking them to cinemas across Europe, America, Australia, as far as, you know, Mexico, it's South America. Unbelievable, the demand for people who want to see Laurel and Hardy in cinemas. So that's where we are now, and the biopic is coming up. That's getting made, and that's a big budget production. That's starts filming in December.
I mean, I have a fascination with Laurel and all that you shared then about the BBC thing. I have the same memory, but I put something on Twitter the other day, and it was true, just saying, just watching my son just howl with laughter at these Laurel and Hardy films on YouTube. It was just like, wow. I mean, and I was trying to explain to him that these comedies are 85 years old. They're nearly a century old.
Yes.
And they're timeless, and I call them the Beatles of comedy. To me, they're unparalleled. I mean, I know there's been great comedic actors and comedic acts, but to me, they are the greatest. They are the. I mean, I think what's his name, Buster Keaton, said at Stan Laurel's funeral, didn't he? That he said he was better than all of us put together. He was funnier than all of us put together. He said.
That's right.
He said, wow.
And look at Buster Keaton, the legend that he is, to say that. And do you know what's ironic?
I know.
Chaplin didn't even mention Stan Laurel in his biography, but they were friends. And Stan always respected.
I know.
Stan always respected Chaplin, never had a bad word to say about him. Whenever they got the chance, they would meet up, you know, occasionally.
Sad.
But for some reason, he was left out
of it. Do you know what? What's interesting? I found out that through reading books as well, which I thought it was fascinating, because they were in the same theatre troupe, weren't they? The Fred Carno troupe.
Yeah, Stan was Chaplin's understudy.
When they went to the States. But I think what Stan Laurel's humour had that Chaplin didn't, and Chaplin was a genius, don't get me wrong. There's a humility to Stan Laurel that comes through his performance, and you don't know what it's an unspoken, you feel it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what elevates him, and obviously, I mean, Ollie was brilliant as well. That's what elevates them to, in my opinion, being the best. I know it's all subjective, but I genuinely believe they were the funniest people that I've ever committed to celluloid. I really do believe that.
Well, I agree, and I think they deserve to be remembered, and it's important that the next generation discovers them, which is why we're really hoping that the BBC put on a run of their films again leading up to the biopic, because they're making the biopic, so why not get them back on TV and introduce them to the next generation? Because they're out there.
Well, I hope you make a documentary as well.
Yeah, I'm going to make a documentary. We're going to start doing that end of this year, start of next year. That's going to start in Ulverston, where Stan was born, and then it's going to finish up in California. I'm really looking forward to doing that, and we'll definitely get you involved in that.
Anything to do with Laurel and Hardy, I'm there. And it's interesting, you know, there was a quote by Stan Laurel about Oliver Hardy. You know, Stan Laurel, I'm sure you know, because you've clearly read the books and you've done your history on it. You know, Stan was more the brains behind the double act. He was the ideas man.
Yeah.
But what was interesting, he said, you know, he always felt that Oliver Hardy was the better actor. I mean, maybe he was being humble with that too, because he was a great actor. But, you know, he said nobody could do that deadpan thing to a camera the way Oliver Hardy could.
I think they were both fantastic actors, but you're right. It's been often said that Oliver is the better actor of the two.
There's no superlatives to describe it. I mean, I know I bore people with my Beatles knowledge, but there are no words to describe the genius of Laurel and Hardy, and you never get bored watching them, ever.
Well, listen, I can't thank you enough for staying on so long. It's brilliant. It's always a pleasure to chat with someone who's doing well with their career, and you're doing absolutely fantastic right now, Stephen. And I'm sure you're getting a lot of attention from the press, and so I really appreciate you coming on my little show.
Listen, any time, and you know, definitely when I'm in Scotland, we're going to have to go and see that theatre.
Okay, Stephen, we're going to play you out with your little ditty. This is Stephen Walters, and this is Outlander.
In 1945, in Bonnie, Scotland, there lived an English rose, and somewhere in that place, through the stones of fate, a history awaits. There is no turning back. When the future's in the past, wherever may find her, she's always an outlander. Wherever you may find her, she's always an outlander. An outlander. An outlander.
Our life together is so precious. Together we have grown. We have grown. Although our love is still special, let's take a chance and fly away somewhere alone.
It's been too long since we took the time. No one's to blame. My no time flies so quickly. Starting over.
I tear out the pages that I've got in these books, just to find just some words to get some reward, and I'd show you all the photographs that I ever got took, and I'd play old 45s that now mean nothing to me. And you're a real gone kid, maybe not, baby. And it's driven me. And let me know, let me know, let me know, let me know about all the old 45s and the paperback rooms, and it's scattered all the photographs of summers and suns. And you're a real gone kid, maybe now, baby.
Black Sky Radio.